From the KCSB FM studio in Santa Barbara, welcome to Radio Causeway. I'm Katrina.
And I'm Tim. This is your weekly showcase bringing you timely interviews and bridging your world of music. Dr. Andy Howell is a staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network and adjunct faculty in the Department of Physics at UC Santa Barbara. He has joined us in studio to discuss his recent paper looking at zombie stars and dark energy.
We'll have the Mullet Strange News and Yeah! Free Music a little later in the show. Stay with us.
Good morning. You're on KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara and streaming live at kcsb.org. This is Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Katrina.
Got a great show lined up for you today. Did you think zombie stars were only in horror films? Well, think again. Dr. Andrew Howell, staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope and a host of Season 3 of Known Universe on Nat Geo, is with us to talk dark energy and its connection to zombie stars. Dr. Howell, welcome to Radio Causeway.
Great. Thanks to be here.
So hearing about zombie stars, this was new for me. I'm assuming it's probably new for most people out there. Can we start at just what exactly is a zombie star? Is it going to be coming for our brains? Or
it really is a white dwarf star, and that's the core of a star like our sun. So our sun is a normal star, but in about 5 billion years, it's going to run out of energy, basically. And what's going to be left is just the core. So it's like something like the mass of the sun, but crammed down into something like the size of the Earth. So these things are tiny, and they're burned out ashes. And if a star like that is in if it's a single star like our sun, it'll just cool off for the rest of time, mm-hmm. and nothing will happen. But if it's in a binary system, if it's got another companion star with it, like about more than half of stars are like this. They're two stars, not one. And in a case like that, a white dwarf star can actually steal matter from its companion star. And when it does, it can actually come back to life. And so it's basically dead, and it's stealing the life force from another star, and it comes back to life as a result. And when that happens, if the white dwarf star gets too massive when it's stealing the matter from this other star, mm-hmm. it can actually just blow up, because there's a limit to how big these things can be. And when it blows up, it's a thermonuclear explosion, or a type 1A supernova, as we sometimes call them. And those things are super bright, and we can see them from all the way across the universe.
And we've seen, humans on Earth have seen them with naked eye in the past.
Yeah, that's right. So supernovae happen about once every 100 years or so in a galaxy. So in the Milky Way, you'd think they'd happen about once every 100 years or so, but it's been about 300 or 400 years since the last one that people have seen. We know people saw one about 400 years ago. People should have seen one about 300 years ago. But since then, nothing in our galaxy. So, and when it happens in our galaxy, you can see it with your naked eye. So some famous astronomers from the past, like Tycho Brahe, Johannes Kepler, have actually seen these supernovae with their naked eye and wrote some things about them that we still use to try to figure out what these types of supernovae were. But today, for me to study supernovae, I need to actually use telescopes and see the supernovae that happen in distant galaxies that are really far away.
You talk about these telescopes. You're part of your staff scientist at the Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network. Can you talk a little bit about what the network is and how it works for yourself and other scientists?
Yeah, it's really exciting. So we're basically developing a network of telescopes for the first time. We put these telescopes all around the world so that there's a ring in the northern hemisphere and a ring in the southern hemisphere, so that as the Earth rotates, we say the sun never rises on the LCOGT empire. So we can always be observing continuously. And we have our headquarters is over in Goleta, and we're building all of these 1 meter telescopes. We're going to build about 18 1 meter telescopes and about 20 0.4 meter telescopes. And then we have two 2 meter telescopes that are working right now. And these telescopes are robotic, so we can basically just tell them what to observe. They go do the observing, so I don't have to go trek up a mountain in the middle of the night and stay up all night and observe, which is fun, but you can't be as efficient as you can when you've got a robotic network. So this is the first time anybody's tried to link a global network of telescopes like this, and so it's really exciting. We're going to be able to do things we never have been able to do before in the history of astronomy.
Yeah, last year on a previous show that I did, I had Drs. Lister and Street on after they had discovered, I think, six extra solar planets or extra... I think I'm getting my terms wrong here, but...
Yeah, extrasolar planets. And yeah, they're great at discovering extrasolar planets. And so that's basically the two of the main things we want to do with this network are find new planets around other stars and find distant supernovae that are exploding.
So your paper is called Type 1A Supernovae as Stellar Endpoints in Cosmological and Cosmological Tools. And it's in Nature Communications. I wouldn't think of supernovae as a cosmological tool. Think the telescopes and whatnot, but can you talk about how these supernovae are or the type 1A supernovae are being used as tools for you guys?
Yeah, it's basically these supernovae are really, really bright, and so we can see them from very far across the universe. And in fact, they're so bright that they can outshine the entire galaxy of 100 billion stars that they're in. So they can just be like, you know, you look in a distant galaxy and the supernova is like brighter than the galaxy. So we can see them from really far away. And that's what makes them cosmological tools. Basically, we can use them to measure distances because we know kind of how bright the supernova is. And then if you put it at a far distance, it's what we call a standard candle. So it's like if I took a light bulb and I knew it was a 100-watt light bulb and I put it a little farther away, I could tell how far away it is just by knowing some basic physics. And so we take these standard light bulbs, basically, so we know all of these supernovae are like 100-watt light bulbs, and then we use them to determine relative distances in the universe. So what we're doing is making a map of the history of the expansion of the universe, because the most distant supernovae light takes a really long time to get here. So it can take billions of years. So sometimes, you know, we see the light from the supernova that left the supernova before the Earth was even here, you know, and then we evolved and made telescopes, and then we can see the photons, and then now we've got a point on our map that says, back at that time, this is how the universe was expanding.
So you talk about Einstein's theory of the cosmological constant. How does that relate to your work?
Yeah, so that's basically gets into this dark energy story. So the crazy thing we learned after we made this map of the expansion of the universe is that it wasn't working at all how we had expected it would work. So we thought that the universe would be slowing down after the Big Bang. So the Big Bang happened, and there's a bunch of, you know, basically the universe is expanding, but it should be slowing down because gravity should be pulling everything back together. But instead, the universe wasn't just expanding, it's speeding up, it's accelerating in its expansion. So something's actually pushing the universe. So we don't know what it's called, and so we call it dark energy just because it's an analog to dark matter, where there's some kind of matter in the universe and we don't know what it is, we call it dark matter. There's some kind of energy in the universe, we don't know what it is, we just call it dark energy. They may not be related to each other. But anyway, we've been trying to figure out what this dark energy is. And so one of the possibilities is something called the cosmological constant, that it's something that Einstein came up with. And he, you know, basically came up with it to sort of balance out the universe, because he realized that, you know, he wanted a static universe because he didn't know the universe was expanding. And so to balance gravity, you can put in this extra term that's sort of like a springiness to space, and that will sort of balance against gravity, and you'll have a static universe. Well, after Hubble figured out that the universe was expanding, he realized he actually didn't need this cosmological constant in his equations. And it turns out, if he hadn't put it in there, he could have predicted that the universe was expanding, because that's a solution to his equations. But so he missed this great prediction by putting in this term, and he called that his biggest blunder, putting that term in. Yeah. But it turns out that that's actually what we need to describe the observations. So that cosmological constant, he thought it was his biggest blunder, but it was actually another great prediction. That's actually how the universe seems to work.
That's when you know you're good.
Yeah, exactly.
Your biggest blunder is an awesome success.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he got the Nobel Prize for one set of things. He could have got it for this other set of things. And now he could have got it for this too, you know. It's amazing.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're on Radio Causeway. Dr. Andy Howell is a staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network, an adjunct faculty in the Department of Physics at UC Santa Barbara. He's in studio with us to discuss his recent paper looking at zombie stars and dark energy. We'll be back with more with Dr. Howell, but right now we've got a quick song break. The band is Years Around the Sun. The song is Miles Away. You're on Radio Causeway.
This is Megan Burney with the Community Environmental Council, and you're listening to Radio Causeway at KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Katrina.
You just heard a song right there from Years Around the Sun, the track Miles Away. Did you think zombies were only in horror films? Well, think again. Dr. Andy Howell, staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope and a host of Season 3 of Known Universe on Nat Geo, is with us to talk dark energy and its connection to zombie stars.
Andy, can you explain the difference for us between dark energy, dark matter, and typical mass?
Sure, yeah. The normal stuff, well, what we call normal, the stuff that we're made of, is baryons, and that's, you know, like protons and neutrons and so on, the stuff you learned about in school. But that's actually not the normal stuff in the universe. We're the weird stuff. We're the freaks in the universe, basically. The kind of stuff we're made of, and stars and everything you've probably ever thought about, it really only makes up about 4% of the universe.
Wow.
And most of the rest of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. So dark matter is some mass that's out there that we've seen from its gravitational effects, like galaxies wouldn't stay together and rotate the way they do without dark matter. And so we can see it's there through all kinds of astrophysical tricks, but it's not a normal particle like the kind that we're made of. And so that stuff is actually dominates over regular matter. So basically, it doesn't affect life on Earth. So our senses didn't evolve to find it, right?
Right.
Our senses are evolved to find, like, you know, food and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But actually, on a larger scale, dark matter is more important than regular matter. The same thing is true for dark energy. We didn't evolve to find this stuff. This stuff is out there, but it's just in small quantities nearby. So in a cubic meter of space, there's only the equivalent amount of, if you could convert energy to mass, the equivalent in mass would be a few atoms of hydrogen. That's how much dark energy there is in a cubic meter. So it's swamped by just, you know, normal hydrogen in the universe and whatever. But the reason it has such a big effect is there's so much space in the universe, basically. This dark energy, over great distances, you sum it up, and it actually has a big effect. So it acts like something like a sort of like a springiness to space. So it's like energy of the vacuum, as far as we can tell. So that in every square meter of space, there's the same amount. And it acts really differently than normal matter. So normal matter, as you say, as space expands, it will dilute.
Right.
So like, for example, you have a cup of water and you double the size of the cup, the volume of the cup, you know, the amount of water stays the same, and you're diluting the amount of water, the density goes down. But dark energy doesn't work like that at all. So as space gets bigger, the amount of dark energy stays the same in each cubic meter. And so it starts to really dominate and really... It's like anti-gravity. It like counters the effect of gravity and makes the universe accelerate.
It's remarkable. Is that the only thing that we know that doesn't dilute?
Yeah, it's the only thing I can think of that behaves this way. And it's really weird stuff. And it's taken us, you know, we've known about normal matter forever, but this stuff we only found in the late 90s for the first time. And it's amazing that the dominant constituent of the universe, this is the main stuff there, we only just found out about. And that's one of the reasons it's very exciting to discover. I mean, to basically research, because, you know, there's great discoveries to be made, and it's, we're so new at trying to figure this out.
How are we able to use the Type 1a supernovae to look at dark energy. How does that work to pair and get some insights into what dark energy is?
Yeah, that's where the cosmological tools part comes in, where we're just using them as these sort of standard candles, these standard light bulbs. So they're kind of like the light posts, the lighthouses. And as the universe expands, basically the space between galaxies is actually getting stretching out. It's getting more and more, you know, if you've ever heard of this term redshift, it's basically how photons get stretched out as they come to us from these distant supernovae. And so that's what's happening. Basically, the photons, the light rays from the distant supernovae are coming to us. They're getting redshifted and they're getting stretched out. And that's because the whole universe is expanding. And so we're measuring this expansion of the universe and how it's changed over time.
Well, I've heard like Andromeda Galaxy is on a interception course with Milky Way. So I guess that doesn't connect with me. The galaxies are all moving apart, but then there's galaxies that are going to be crashing into each other.
Right, exactly. So Andromeda is one of the rare exceptions of a galaxy that's actually moving toward us. Uh-huh. Every other galaxy is moving far away, or almost every other galaxy. And that's just because on really close scales, we're gravitationally bound to the Andromeda Galaxy. So gravity, the force of gravity is stronger than the force of dark energy because it's so close. But once you go a little farther away, dark energy is more important than gravity. And so basically in the far future, we won't be able to, distant astronomers in the future could look up in the sky and they'll see like Andromeda will have merged with our galaxy and made one big galaxy, but they may see some other really close galaxies, but they won't see any other galaxies in the sky because they will have expanded beyond the horizon. So they'll have expanded so far away the light can't get to us. And so that, future astronomers may not even believe what we find out in astronomy today, because they'll say, millions of years ago people thought this, but that's not the way the sky looks, so that must have been some ancient religion or something like that. And so we live sort of in a special time in the universe where we can figure these things out,
observation being central to scientists.
Yeah, exactly. So observations are going to get harder in the billions of years in the future, so there's nothing we have to worry about. But it's once you start to get a model of how the universe works, you can think about these things, about what was it like in the Big Bang, and then what's it going to be like in the far future of the universe.
Another interesting project that you've been working on, and I think it's your most recent publication, is talking about hydrogen poor superluminous stellar explosions. Can you talk about what? Yeah, it's a mouthful.
Yeah.
I just had breakfast right there, but
yeah. And in fact, we need an even better title for this. These kinds of supernovae are so new, we don't even have a name for them yet. So these are like the most powerful supernovae in the universe. They're way more powerful than anything we've ever seen before. And they're kind of rare, and they tend to happen in the strange environments somewhat. But they're so powerful that the normal way you make a supernova, I talked about the zombie stars and the thermonuclear supernovae before. Those are type 1A supernovae. Mm-hmm. But a supernova that more people are probably familiar with is when a massive star reaches the end of its life, it collapses and then explodes. And that's a type 2 supernova. Those are more common supernovae in the universe. But these stars are probably related. I mean, these supernovae are probably related to those, the ones we just published. But they're so powerful that the normal process of collapse into a neutron star or a black hole actually can't power the supernova, and at least the normal process and the way we understand it. These supernovae are so bright that we basically don't know how to get that much energy out from some kind of process. So there are a few theories, but they don't really work all that well. So these supernovae are so crazy that I actually had one for years that I've had the data, and I've been looking at it, and I'm like, I have no idea what this is. It's just crazy. And so I even gave a talk at a conference and said, what the hell is this? And I asked my colleagues, and they couldn't figure it out. And for years, it just sat there until we got some other clues, and then we started piecing the story all together. So my colleagues down at Caltech are leading this current paper. And they've basically put together this story that the reason I couldn't figure out what these supernovae were before was that the light is redshifted into the ultraviolet. These things are so far away that I was looking at the photons thinking that they're sort of in the optical part, like the visual part of the spectrum, like how our eyes can see. Right. But it turns out this stuff is really ultraviolet photons that have been redshifted, and we're seeing signatures of elements that we don't ever normally see because the ultraviolet is blocked by the Earth's atmosphere. So we're seeing things we've never seen before, and we're just in the process of trying to figure out how these things work, what they're made of, and it's really exciting because it's something, you know, humans have been studying the supernovae for maybe 1,000 years before we even knew what they were, but maybe, you know, in really in earnest in maybe 70 years or something like that. And yet we're finding new types even today.
Do you get to name these things that you discover? How does that work?
Yeah, unfortunately, no. Everybody always asks me that. Like, I see some friend, they're like, hey, can you name a supernova after me? But you can name comets and asteroids after people. Well, especially really asteroids. But supernovae, the bad part is we have like an automatic naming system. So they're usually like 2011 A or 2011 B and so on. And so we go through the alphabet. And that's helpful because we actually find so many that it's hard to spend time coming up with a name. We've tried this to come up with fun names for certain ones. Like we had composers for a little while, or people have tried different like Lord of the Rings characters or something like that. But then you run out of all of these things. And so we need some sort of automatic process.
Right. One of the things I wanted to have you give your opinion on or just thoughts about, we just got to we just retired the shuttle program, and now we're kind of in a transition period of what's next for space exploration. I was wondering if you could lend your thoughts on where things are going. And you'd mentioned that an asteroid, and we just had our first satellite orbiting around an asteroid in the Kuiper Belt, if I'm correct. Yeah.
Well, this one's actually closer than the Kuiper Belt. But yeah, we just sent a spacecraft, Dawn, to an asteroid, Vesta, which is basically the biggest asteroid that's not spherical. So you might have heard this controversy over Pluto. Is it a planet or not?
Right.
And so actually the biggest asteroid in the Astro Belt series is spherical, and it's sort of like a dwarf planet, like what in the category that Pluto's now in. Vesta is the next biggest one that's not quite spherical. And it is really exciting that we have sent, you know, a spacecraft that can orbit it and tell us all about it. And so there's sort of two parts to the space program. One is the robotic pure science missions, and I'm, you know, a big fan of those as a scientist, of course, and we can learn a whole lot and do it relatively cheaply. But I also really like the manned exploration, space exploration programs, because that's like a totally different kind of experience, and right. You get this sense of adventure and accomplishment and, you know, really doing something incredible. So I am kind of sad to see the space shuttle program come to an end. When I was filming on the show Known Universe, I actually got to go to all of these NASA sites and talk to some of the astronauts and really, you know, hang out in a mock-up of the shuttle and, you know, pretend I'm flying and all these other things.
Amazing.
And it's really, really fun. And I really see all the sense of adventure there. Sad to see it come to an end. But on the other hand, you know, the space shuttle is kind of a death trap. I mean, the thing is very dangerous.
Right.
You've got this falling foam. The design is not really what we need to go forward. And so the sad part right now is that we're in sort of a transition period where the U.S. doesn't really have a launch vehicle. We have to go use the Russians. So, you know, U.S. astronauts will still go to space. We still got the space station. It's just our pride is a little hurt, maybe, because we don't have our own vehicle. There's, you know, one being designed that will be the next generation one. But we're in a little bit of a period here. Like when I grew up, when it was after the Apollo program, before the space shuttle, we're in that period again where things aren't maybe quite as exciting because you don't get to go see a launch, but you know, we're still sending astronauts.
Mars or Moon, where do you see, what do you think as the next target?
Yeah, I guess we've done the Moon. It's really exciting, though, of course. You know, you want to do some, you know, that's the easiest part. And I mean, it's not easy by any means, but we've spent all this time on the space program, and it is sad to see that we're not going to destinations. But the hard part is Mars is really hard to get to.
Right.
So it takes a lot of work, a lot of dedication. It'll take, you know, decades to get to Mars. I'd love to see it happen in my lifetime. I would volunteer to go. Okay. But it's a really hard journey, and Mars is a really hard place. You know, basically, it doesn't have a magnetic field. It doesn't have shielding from radiation. And it's a dangerous thing for people. We have a lot to learn before we can get there. But I definitely want to see it happen.
Where can people find more about the work that you're doing, both at personal work and also the work at Las Cumbres?
Yeah, so Las Cumbres Observatory has a great web page, lcogt.net, and you can actually see some observations from our telescopes there and see the progress of the telescopes that we're building. And then my personal webpage is dahowell.googlepages.com, and you know, I just have a little bit about my latest research on there.
Well, I wish we had more time. We can go on for days with all the stuff that you're involved in. Dr. Andy Howell is a staff scientist at Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network and adjunct faculty in the Department of Physics at UC Santa Barbara, as well as host of Season 3 of Known Universe. He's joined us today to discuss his recent paper looking at zombie stars and dark energy. Dr. Howell, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
All right, we got a quick song break. It is from Modest Mouse. The track is Dark Center of the Universe. You're on Radio Causeway.
This is my impersonation of a radio voice. Hi, this is blank from blank. No, okay, sorry. This is Andy Bicklebaum.
And Mike Bonanno.
From?
Where are we from?
The Yes Men.
Oh, that's right.
And you're listening to Radio Causeway.
Is that a name? Uh-huh. On KCSB 91.9 FM,
Santa Barbara.
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Katrina.
Just heard a track right there from Modest Mouse off the Moon in Antarctica album. The track was Dark Center of the Universe.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
It is time for the Mullet Strange News.
Mullet Strange News time. Get us kicked off with something. This was from a couple months back in March. Thought it was so good, we couldn't pass it up. Reported by the Columbus Dispatch. Fire station, a potential fire hazard.
Yeah.
The Chillicothe firefighters must make up for a bad alarm system 24 hours a day. The Chillicothe Fire Station number 1 is considered a fire hazard by the Ohio State Fire Marshal. Due to budget cuts, the Chillicothe Fire Station number 1 is the only operating station in that city. It comes down to a dysfunctional fire detection and alarm system, in addition to a fire sprinkler that hadn't received an inspection. I guess they're spending their time going out and inspecting everybody else's fire stuff. They're not inspecting their own.
Yeah.
But in order to keep the station open, they have to designate an on-duty fireman to patrol the station 24 hours a day on, quote, fire watch, end quote.
That shouldn't be much of a problem.
They're going from the basement to the second floor, nonstop patrolling, walking through. In an April 11th update to the story, the sprinkler system was inspected, but needs improvement. And the alarm system still has not been fixed.
Go!
Yeah.
And now for something completely different.
Right, so parents make many important decisions over the course of a child's life. Some of the really big ones happen even before the baby is born, like choosing a name. Now, in most places, you're free to name your child whatever you wish, no matter how unusual your choice may be.
Fascinating.
David and Victoria Beckham welcomed their new daughter with the moniker Harper 7. Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin named their children Apple and Moses.
Yummy!
And in keeping with today's solar theme, let's not forget Frank Zappa has a daughter named Moon Unit.
Frank Scott!
Not in New Zealand. Australia's Herald Sun reports the country's registrar of births, deaths, and marriages has been cracking down on parents who get too creative. Lucifer, Duke, and 89 have recently been added to the prohibited list that already includes the letters C, D, T, and I.
Warning! Warning!
The agency has also refused to allow names including commas, periods, and exclamation points. You can, however, name your twins Benson and Hedges, or Violence and Number 16 Bus Shelter.
Oh, that's good to know.
No, it's not like that everywhere. Some countries are less strict, if a little more arbitrary. For instance, quoting directly from the Global Post, in Sweden, name choices are subject to a naming law. While Lego and Google have been approved as names for children, Superman, Metallica, and Elvis, and the name that I'm just going to say is a series of letters that ends in 11116, pronounced Alden, were not approved.
I was going to name my child that if I lived in Sweden, but guess not.
That's the Mullet Strange News for this week.
How much do I owe you?
Half of nothing.
You mean it's free?
You feeling the love?
It's time for our Yeah! Free Music Pick of the Week, where we find music that's been made available for free and legal download and use in podcasts, and we make it available for you at radiocausway.org. What do we got this week?
This is a track from Cranston. It's called And So It Begins. It's from their Harder Times LP. From John Badger Farms label.
You're on Radio Causeway.
How much do I owe you?
Half of nothing.
You mean it's free?
You feeling the love?
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Katrina.
That was our Yeah! Free Music pick of the week. Make it available on radiocauseway.org. What did we just hear?
That's And So It Begins from Cranston off of their Harder Times release. That's due in 2011. It's from the experimental pop, sound, poetry, and minimalism genres.
What do we got coming up next?
We have a track from Silver Swans called Mother of Pearl.
You're on Radio Causeway.
Radio Causeway
can help your love life.
Oh, really? Wow.
You can be sure that you have the highest quality product when you own a
Radio Causeway.
You will achieve better health, enjoy soothing massages, and have a sexy body after using the
Radio Causeway.
That's why I went out and bought
Radio Causeway.
It filters out irritating smoke, allowing my family to breathe cleaner, fresher smelling air.
KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.
To prevent it from moving.
I come out of the bathroom, you have
Radio Causeway.
Yes, I could go out of the house immediately after using
Radio Causeway.
Hey, this Christmas party is getting a little too quiet. I think it's time we liven it up with my favorite Christmas gift.
Radio Causeway.
Well, you set the dial on your FM radio and
testing.
When your sideburns get too bushy, just trim them with a
Radio Causeway.
Perfect for cutting children's hair. Just comb. No matter how much they squirm, you can give them a good haircut without nicking or gouging.
Oh my gosh, this is amazing.
That feels great on my abs.
My wife used to always complain about the pressure from her shoulder belt. Not anymore.
Radio Causeway.
Worked so great, he got one for himself, too.
Listen Tuesday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. on KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.
This is amazing.
This is pretty much the worst video ever made.
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
And I'm Katrina.
What'd we hear right there?
We finished that off with Shooting Stars from Bag Raiders. We started with a track called Mother of Pearl from Silver Swans off of their Forever LP that will be released later this year. They're a group out of San Francisco, and that is a reference for you, Tim, for Comic-Con this weekend. Silver Swans were a group of supervillains from Wonder Woman.
There's plenty of villains and heroes and henchmen and all the rest down there, for sure.
If you want to catch any of the show or interview, find us on kcsb.org or radiocauseway.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Thanks for joining us.
Special thanks to Dave from the Grave for giving us a call, and special thanks to Dr. Andy Howell, staff scientist from Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network, for taking the time to speak with us today. Our theme music was produced by Forrest Seguin. Next week, we will be speaking with a representative from Surgical Eye Expeditions International on their new Santa Barbara County program delivering free examinations to prevent blindness due to diabetes. Thanks for listening.
Be well.
This program is a presentation of KCSB Public Affairs. The opinions expressed were those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KCSB, the Associated Students, or the Regents of the University of California.
If you have a comment or wish to respond, please address correspondence to KCSB University Center, Room 3185A, University of California, Santa Barbara, California, 93106. This is KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.